It is time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. And I suggest you have a pencil and paper handy because you might want to write something down. Snapshot Day is coming. The 14th annual Central Coast Regional Snapshot Day, brought to us by the Coastal Watershed Council, is going to be on Saturday, May 4th from 9 to 1 p.m. In partnership with the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary and hundreds of community volunteers, they will systematically sample streams along 300 miles of California's coastline. At the Coastal Watershed Council, we're organizing teams of volunteers to monitor sites across Santa Cruz and San Mateo counties. The Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary will organize teams for Monterey and San Luis Obispo counties. We'll be collecting valuable water quality data such as pH, dissolved oxygen, electrical conductivity, and transparency. We'll also collect water samples for laboratory analysis of bacteria and nutrients like nitrates and orthophosphates. And if you want to know why any of those things are important, come to one of the classes and bring your friends and family. Trainings will be held in Santa Cruz on Saturday, April 27th from 10 a.m. to 12 or from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Santa Cruz Yacht Harbor Public Meeting Room, 365 Lake Avenue, Suite A, or in San Mateo on Monday, April 29th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the San Gregorio General Store, Highway 84 and Stage Road, just up from the beach there. In Monterey, training will be on Sunday, April 28th from 10:30 in the morning till 12:30 at the REI Store on General Stillwell Drive in Marina. And in San Luis Obispo, the training will be on Tuesday, April 30th from 5:30 to 7:30 at the Coastal Discovery Center, Hearst State Beach in San Simeon. If you'd like to get involved, just remember Saturday, May 4th is the day. Get trained in advance. For more information, go to the Coastal Watershed Council's website, or you might give Debbie a call, her number 831-464-9200, or just go to coastal-watershed.org. Well, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has handed down a ruling in favor of Japanese whale poachers and against the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. In response to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals' opinion on a preliminary injunction hearing against the Sea Shepherds, brought by Japan's Institute for Cetacean Research, and that's a government-subsidized front for commercial whaling, the global marine conservation nonprofit calls the ruling a bad decision, but says the gavel hasn't come down quite yet. A ruling from a pending trial and other legal actions are yet to come. Meanwhile, the group says Japan's whale-poaching pirates of greed are literally getting away with murder, the murder of whales. Moreover, Sea Shepherd has called for the case to be reviewed again before an 11-judge Ninth Circuit Court panel. The Ninth Circuit Court issued a temporary injunction in December in favor of the Japanese whale poaching fleet and against Sea Shepherd U.S.'s activities in the Southern Ocean, overturning a decision by the Honorable District Court Judge Richard A. Jones in March of last year. At the time, the temporary injunction was issued with no opinion whatsoever. The opinion was finally issued late Monday and ignored the well-reasoned ruling in Sea Shepherd's favor by Judge Jones. In this most recent ruling, the Ninth Circuit called Sea Shepherd pirates, but it is indeed the whale poachers who are the real pirates in this scenario, pirates of greed and murder. At the press conference at the National Press Club earlier this month, the iconic environmental attorney Robert F. Kennedy Jr. echoed that sentiment about the ICR. The Institute for Cetacean Research is an arm of the Japanese government, is really a pirate organization masquerading as a scientific research group. If you are violating international law in the high seas, you are a pirate, he added. And we have in our country a long and proud history of battling piracy on the high seas, beginning in 1805 when Thomas Jefferson sent the Marines to Tripoli to subdue the Barbary pirates, and we ought not trying to impede Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherds, but we should be issuing him letters of marque in order to support and recognize the important value of his activities to our country and to the world community in battling a pirate organization that is in violation of international laws. He is performing a profound public service for us all, and instead of recognizing him, the U.S. government, various agencies of the U.S. government have attempted to impede him, Kennedy Jr. said. Letters of marque were historically used by governments many years ago to seize genuine pirate ships. They were a government license authorizing a person known as a privateer to attack and capture enemy vessels and bring them before admiralty courts for condemnation and sale. In addition, in a highly questionable and unprofessional move, the three-panel member of the Ninth Circuit Court called into question Judge Jones's well-articulated ruling in which he said Sea Shepherd was acting in the public interest for the protection of wildlife and the earth. He also reasoned further that the group's activities amount to nothing more than low-level harassment. Still clearly unconcerned with the plight of the planet, the Ninth Circuit made a rare and unwarranted decision that Jones should be removed from the case, with one of the three judges dissenting on that ruling. Clearly, this is a bad decision by the Ninth Circuit Court, but not unexpected, said Scott West, Director of Intelligence and Investigations for the Sea Shepherd U.S. It's not an opinion. Everyone has one. We happen to agree with Judge Jones's well-articulated and reasoned opinion on the matter, he stated. Beyond that, the vitriolic and grandstanding manner in which the Ninth Circuit rendered its opinion makes us seriously doubt their qualifications for making a just decision. This court is part of the problem, not of the solution. Not only is there no room for such a biased and unprofessional legal opinion, they somehow have the audacity to throw a highly respected, honored judge, one of their own, under the bus in order to side with foreign commercial interests. Is this a decision of an American court, or have we somehow mistakenly landed in Japan? West added. Sea Shepherd U.S. will continue to seek relief with regard to the injunction by going back to the full Ninth Circuit and a hand-picked judge of the U.S. Supreme Court. However, the first foray to the designated Supreme Court justice was denied. And I might add that things have really heated up in the South Seas. Mishin Maru, the Rob Barker, and an oil tanker have all been involved in repeated bumpings. Of course, Sea Shepherd is calling them rammings, and the Japanese are calling them rammings, but basically they're playing bumper cars out there with big boats. It can't be fun. It's extremely dangerous. And at one point, the Rob Barker was pinned between the oil tanker and the Mishin Maru. Let's just all pray for the good folks on the Sea Shepherd boats and hope the Japanese run out of fuel and go home. And in really good news, moving to the other end of the planet, Shell Oil has announced they are pulling out of Arctic drilling for 2013. Great news for the Arctic, polar bears, and other creatures of the far north. Shell Oil has announced it won't drill in Alaska's Beaufort or Chukchi seas this coming summer. Wednesday's announcement follows a series of mishaps for Shell in the Arctic, including one of its drilling rigs running aground earlier this year. The Center for Biological Diversity and its allies have been pushing for years to stop drilling in the Arctic Ocean, home to polar bears and other imperiled creatures that would be devastated by an oil spill. More than a million people sent messages to President Obama last year, urging him not to allow Arctic drilling. Shell began exploratory drilling operations last summer, but was beset by a series of mishaps. Although Shell calls this simply a pause in its plans for Arctic drilling, we think it ought to be a permanent stop, said Rebecca Noblin, the Center for Biological Diversity's Alaska director. Drilling in the Arctic can never be made safe for polar bears, whales, and ice seals, or for the fragile ecosystems where they live. President Obama ought to use this opportunity to rethink his support for Arctic drilling and take it off the table forever. The Auburn Dam, is it back again? In this story by Rob Stork, Policy Director of Friends of the River. Last week, the Sacramento Bee reported that Representative Tom McClintock had imposed some conditions on support for reauthorizing of a federal levee project that protects the Natomas Basin of Sacramento and southern Sutter counties, and that is the Auburn Dam. The giant 680-foot-high dam on the North Fork of the American River had been laid to rest many times by seismicity concerns during the Carter administration, by the fiscal discipline of Ronald Reagan, by Mother Nature washing away the 200-foot-high Auburn Cofferdam, and by George H.W. Bush because of unresolved differences between the Corps of Engineers and his environmental agencies, by a series of congressional votes and non-votes against the dam, by George W. Bush's Secretary of the Interior beginning the reconstruction of the downstream Folsom Dam to meet Sacramento's desire for a lot more control over American River flood flows, and by the Sacramento area moving on to other floodwater management easement and other water supply projects, and by the California State Water Resources Control Board stripping the dam of its water rights. In the meantime, the U.S. Bureau of Land Management found the Auburn State Recreation Area, formed to encompass the Auburn Dam Reservoir and parts of the South Fork, to be suitable for National Recreation Area status, and the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation found the river segments in the Auburn State Recreation Area to be eligible for National Wild and Scenic River status. Yet Representative McClintock still has a dream to build the Auburn Dam, and he doesn't mind taking hostages to get it. We've been down this road before. By 1989, State Senator John Doolittle was crusading that there will be no dam at Auburn unless it turns 48 miles of the American River into a reservoir. In 1995, as he ascended to the same chairmanship in the House of Representatives that Representative McClintock now holds, he had his press secretary deliver an ultimatum to the Sacramento Area Flood Control Agency that there will be no alternative flood control approaches. It is the Auburn Multipurpose Dam or nothing. And Representative McClintock has just done the same. It's easy to dismiss Representative Tom McClintock. He's just a throwback to another less environmentally conscious era. True, but he is the chairman of the House Subcommittee on Water and Power. There, he has almost single-handedly blocked the Klamath River settlement to remove the dams in the Klamath River, and now he wants to hold the capital of California hostage unless Congress reauthorizes the Auburn Dam. It's time to write to your congressman. For more information, go to FOR.org. That's Friends of the River, FOR.org. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. Between Thursday and Sunday, 44 of America's last wild buffalo were killed in the Gardner Basin by hunters with the Nez Perce and Umatilla tribes. Most of these buffalo were shot less than 300 yards from the northern boundary of Yellowstone National Park on a small area of Gallatin National Forest land called Beatty Gulch. Three of the buffalo were shot here, did not immediately fall, but walked into Yellowstone, where they were not allowed to be retrieved by the Nez Perce hunters who had shot them. Their bodies were left to the ecosystem. According to state and tribal officials, the hunters who shot these buffalo are being allowed to keep their tags to kill other buffalo. In another incident, three other buffalo were illegally shot and killed by two non-tribal members. 2 days later, we watched as more than 100 buffalo approached these killing fields. They found the remains of their relatives strewn across the land like fleshy boulders left behind by glaciers. We watched in sorrowful awe as the buffalo approached the gut piles. Their tails shot up in the air as they ran from remains to remains, discovering what was left. Enormous bulls bellowed like roaring dragons, mouths agape, bodies arched, and pawed the ground. The buffalo placed their faces close to the flesh left behind, nuzzling their nuzzles into the earth where the buffalo had fallen. They sniffed at fetuses still sheltered in their mother's flesh, whose lives were ended before they were even born. The buffalo circled and scattered, ran to each other and away again, sparring, bumping, running, pawing, and crying out in their deep emotion of their discovery. Watching, we could only think of it as a wake, a mighty wailing of the buffalo. Back and forth they ran, frantic between the gut piles that had been their friends and their family. Like chieftains in their own right, fathers of their clans, the mature bulls lingered the longest as the mothers and grandmothers lead the young ones on in an ancient procession, their deliberate footsteps slower in their sorrow. The depth of relationship the buffalo share is timeless, intense, and far beyond most people's willingness or ability to accept and understand. Indeed, it is easier, more convenient to ignore or pretend that it doesn't mean anything. In that blindness, we deny not only to other creatures but to ourselves the honest power of love, the gift of respect, and the aid of wisdom. The buffalo already encompass these things, and they are patiently waiting on the brink for us to catch up. And a brucellosis workshop has been held in Montana. Yellowstone National Park and Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks held a 3-day workshop on brucellosis this week. Brucellosis is the supposed dreaded disease that livestock interests claim wild buffalo will transmit back to cattle, something that has never happened in the wild. Agencies involved with the highly controversial Interagency Bison Management Plan were seeking advice and recommendations from select scientists whose expertise spanned from wildlife ecology to vaccinology. The IBMP agencies presented their stakeholder perspectives and then heard presentations from the panelists. At the At the core of the discussion was the feasibility of administering brucellosis vaccines to wild bison, specifically through remote vaccination, that is, bio bullets, something the Buffalo Field Campaign strongly opposes and the agencies, spearheaded by Yellowstone, have been working on implementing for a number of years, even though each agency, save the Montana Department of Livestock, agrees that it's not the way to go. The Montana Department of Livestock claimed that brucellosis was the handcuffs that were keeping wild bison from roaming more of Montana. The Montana Department of Livestock aimed to push their agenda for vaccinating wild buffalo, saying if this program was carried out, wild bison would be free to roam and livestock interests would gladly welcome them on more areas of the landscape. This we already know to be false. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks reminded the Montana Department of Livestock that brucellosis was not the driving issue, as even brucellosis-free bison were still viewed as a threat by state livestock interests and were not welcome to roam free. Even so, Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks mismanages wild bison in accordance with livestock interests and is already carrying out harmful programs targeting elk. Nearly 2 days into the meetings, it had become clear... that the IBMP agencies weren't actually interested in what the panel of experts were recommending, but were rather hoping for validation of the IBMP agency's plans to vaccinate wild bison. They didn't get it. After presentations and question and answer sessions, the panelists brought forth their recommendation to the IBMP agencies. At this time, it is not anticipated that a vaccine program will improve the risk of transmission, nor is it a more efficient use of resources. The panelists further stated that in cattle, there was an economic motivation to eradicate the disease. It's not the same motivation for bison. Yellowstone National Park and the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks addressed the panelists' recommendations, basically saying that they were inconvenient, didn't suit them politically or socially, and requested that the panel reword their recommendations. These two hosting agencies urged the panel to wrap things up so that the last day of meetings could end early. And these are the folks who are making the decisions about how America's last wild buffalo will live or will die. Align your life with your ideals. Come to work for the Buffalo Field Campaign. The Buffalo Field Campaign is currently accepting applications for our office coordinator position. This job located at the Buffalo Field Campaign headquarters near West Yellowstone will be open in May of 2013, applicants should be well organized, personable, and articulate. Experience with Microsoft Office programs is a must, as is knowledge and passion for wild bison and the Buffalo Field Campaign. For a full job description and information on how to apply, please visit our website. We also have immediate openings for field volunteers. Between now and June, we need people to staff our frontline patrols. In the summer, we'll need education and outreach volunteers to represent the Buffalo Field Campaign and the Buffalo to Yellowstone visitors. If you're interested, passionate, and hardworking, please reply by going to the website, and you will find more information and volunteer information about Buffalo Field Campaign at the website. Here's their address, Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip 59758. Their phone number, 406-646-0070. And this and all their information can be found at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And please remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And permafrost and thaw in one sentence? Oh yeah. Melting of significant portions of the Arctic permafrost could accelerate climate change into a catastrophe in this story by David Biello of Scientific American. Permafrost is not so permanent. Across the Arctic, swaths of once frozen solid ground have begun to thaw. If the records preserved in the Siberian caves are accurate, much more of the region could melt if temperatures continued to warm. Geoscientist Anton Vax of the University of Oxford led an international team of experts, including the Arabica Caving Club in Irkutsk, in sampling the spindly cave growths known as stalagmites and stalactites across Siberia and down into the Gobi Desert of China. Taking samples of such speleothems from six caves, researchers then reconstructed the last roughly 500,000 years of climate via the decay of radioactive particles in the stone. When the ground is frozen above a cave, no water seeps into it, making such formation relics from warmer periods before permafrost formed, the researchers wrote in a study published online in Science on the 21st of February. Details of the study reveal that conditions were warm enough, even in Siberia, for these mineral deposits to form roughly 400,000 years ago, when the global average temperature was 1.5 degrees Celsius higher than present. It also suggests that there was no permafrost in the Lena River region at that time, because enough water seeped into the northernmost cave to enable roughly 8 centimeters of growth in the formations. That was, in fact, the last time the formations in the Ledyananaya Lenskaya cave grew, although other caves further south showed multiple periods of growth coinciding with other warmer periods. That boundary area of continuous permafrost starts to degrade when the mean global temperature is 1.5 degrees C higher than present, Vax explained. Such a warming is a threshold after which continuous permafrost zone starts to be vulnerable to global warming. Since Vax's present is the pre-industrial late Holocene, that means the planet is already more than halfway there, having experienced 0.8 degrees C warming to date. Such a thaw is no small matter, given that permafrost covers nearly a quarter of the land in the northern hemisphere and holds roughly 1,700 gigatons of carbon, or roughly twice as much carbon as is currently trapping heat in the atmosphere. Much of that carbon would end up in the atmosphere if the permafrost was to thaw further. That may not have occurred during the warm period 400,000 years ago, known as the marine isotope stage 11 to scientists, which featured elements such as boreal forest on Greenland and higher sea levels. The thawing was probably very brief because the layer deposited on the northernmost cave stalactite was relatively thin, Vax says. Too thin, in fact, to determine how long the warm period lasted. We don't see any extraordinary increase in atmospheric CO2 or methane during MIS 11. And the Gobi Desert might benefit enjoying wetter conditions in the future if the record in this cave is accurate. It's not clear how far north such thawing might extend if global average temperatures continue to warm until they match those from long ago. Now we are looking for caves with speleothems in northern Siberia to answer this question, Vax notes, adding that in the northernmost cave is already much warmer than in the late 18th century based on historical reports. Further research could be done by taking sediment cores from Arctic river deltas or lakes, but this remains an epic task given the vastness and remoteness of the region. But already it is clear that global climates, not much warmer than present, are enough to thaw even more permafrost, maybe even as far north as 60 degrees latitude. The potential impact of these results extends to global policy. These results indicate the potential release of large amounts of carbon from thawed permafrost, even if we attain the 2 degrees C warming target under negotiation, said Kevin Schaefer, a scientist at the U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center, who has also studied permafrost but was not involved in this study, in his words, great science effort. Permafrost thaws slowly, and the carbon will be released into the atmosphere over 2 or 3 centuries, he added. And here we have some news from the Center for Biological Diversity. An appeals court has opened the door for disclosure of Gulf spill chemicals. The federal appeals court has ruled that a lower court had erred in dismissing the Center for Biological Diversity's suit seeking full disclosure of the amount and type of chemicals that spilled into the Gulf of Mexico during the 2010 Deepwater Horizon spill. The disaster killed 11 people and spewed 200 million gallons of oil, methane, and other toxins. The center filed a lawsuit in the summer of 2010 seeking a $20 billion penalty from BP and Transocean under the Clean Water Act to restore the Gulf, as well as full disclosure under a federal right-to-know law of everything that was spilled. The latest court decision denied the Clean Water Act claims, unfortunately, but offered new hope for the disclosure of chemicals. The public deserves the right to know exactly what toxins were spilled into our oceans during the Gulf spill, so we're very pleased to be a step closer with this ruling, said Miyoko Sakashida, Oceans Director at the Center. And Pacific bluefin tuna levels have fallen 96%. Like Atlantic bluefin tuna, Pacific bluefin tuna easily traverse the ocean except when they're snagged and slaughtered by commercial fisheries for an enormous profit. Just like their Atlantic relatives, Pacific bluefin are in dire need of respite from overfishing, a fact now well supported by a scientific report recently released concluding that their population is at a historic low, having declined an astonishing 96.4%. from unfished levels. Only a few days before the report came out, a single Pacific bluefin tuna brought $1.76 million in a Tokyo auction. And due to overfishing, most Pacific bluefin tuna don't even have a chance to reproduce before becoming sushi. Today, more than 90% of bluefin tuna caught haven't even reached 2 years old. 70% of those bluefin caught were younger than a year, just babies according to Pacific bluefin, that normally live 15 to 30 years. And here's some news from the wild and weird. The rootin' tootin' bandit mouse eats scorpions and then howls at the moon. Forget Billy the Kid and Pancho Villa. Oncoremus torridus, a small carnivorous mouse with tiny pink paws, may just be the roughest, toughest outlaw the West has ever known. Also called the grasshopper mouse, this adorable bandito prowls the harsh, arid badlands of the Sonoran Desert in the United States and Mexico, stalking crickets, rodents, scorpions, and tarantulas to sate its monstrous hunger. It battles other rodents, driving them away by force up to and including death. It also steals their burrows. Scientists believe grasshopper mice collect a variety of fleas, perhaps as grisly souvenirs from their rodent victims, some of which they cannibalize. To get this, after biting the head off of a scorpion and feasting on its flesh, one mouse has been known to throw its head back in wild delight and howl at the moon. Seriously. And protection has been proposed for the rare sage grouse, plus 1.7 million acres. Under the Center for Biological Diversity's landmark 757 species agreement, rare and spectacular Gunnison sage grouse have now been proposed for Endangered Species Act protection, along with more than 1.7 million acres of their habitat. These birds and their sagebrush home have needed help for decades, yet in response to a year 2000 petition from conservation groups, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service gave the grouse mere candidate status. Finally, the bird has been proposed for protection to help defend it from livestock grazing, oil and gas drilling, and other threats. Gunnison sage grouse, which are distinct from all other sage grouse species, occur in just 7 small populations in southwestern Colorado and southeastern Utah. Males are remarkable in appearance with flashy plumage and inflatable air sacs. Their intricate mating performances are unique, involving different vocalizations and dance moves from those displayed by their cousins. Upon ending their courtship dances, for instance, Gunnison sage grouse wag their tails. And a beautiful Bolivian bird flies toward protection. In the latest good news from the Center for Biological Diversity's International Birds Initiative, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed to protect Bolivia's colorful blue-throated macaw under the Endangered Species Act. The center has been working to protect this and scores of other exotic avians across the globe since 2003, when we first sued the service over its delay in proposing protections for 73 foreign birds. As a result of that lawsuit, the service issued a long overdue finding that more than 50 of the species were warranted protection, but they kept insisting it had to delay that protection because of higher priority actions. Since then, more center lawsuits in 2006 and 2009 have advanced safeguards for many of these rare birds. The blue-throated macaw, which has been waiting for final protection since 1991, suffers from trapping, mostly for the pet trade, and possibly only 100 birds are left alive in the wild. U.S. protection would grant tighter trade restrictions and increase conservation funding to this long-tailed, gorgeous turquoise and yellow parrot. And a year after a mining halt, uranium threats to the Grand Canyon still loom. 1 year after the federal government enacted new protections limiting uranium mine development on 1 million acres around Grand Canyon National Park, following years of advocacy by the Center for Biological Diversity and their allies, pollution and legal threats from the uranium industry remain. 5 uranium industry suits, one seeking $120 million from U.S. taxpayers, as well as plans to reopen 2 mines from the 1980s, still threaten public and tribal land and water in and around the world-famous park. Consolidated into one suit, the claims are now before a federal district court in Arizona to defend the protection of Grand Canyon lands from uranium mining. The Havasupai tribe and conservation groups have intervened in that suit. The Obama administration's agencies are allowing old mines to reopen without updating ancient or environmental studies, said Taylor McKinnon, the center's wildlands campaign's director. These mines will bring the same pollution the mineral restrictions intended to block. Their approval in the 1980s was a terrible idea. Allowing those mines to reopen now on the basis of the outdated science in their environmental impact reports is even worse. And for more information on this and other environmental issues, go to www.biologicaldiversity.org. And that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. Tune in next Thursday evening here at Free Radio Santa Cruz for another edition of the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update can also be heard on Free Radio Moscow, Idaho, at 92.5 FM on 9:30 p.m. on, I believe that's Monday nights. All right. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. You can find archived downloadable podcasts at radioforall.net.